Hello, this is Orson Welles speaking. On his way to the peace conference in Paris, Mr. Clement Attlee, the Prime Minister, remembered a cartoon he'd seen 25 years before in the London Daily Herald. It showed the big four of 1919, Wilson and Lloyd George, Clemenceau and Orlando, walking out of the peace conference of 1919, having written the Treaty of Versailles, and Clemenceau had stopped the others. Curious, the old lion was saying. Curious. I seem to hear a child crying. The cartoon, Mr. Attlee remembered, showed a child, a weeping child, labeled in a bitterly wonderful moment of prophecy, Class of 1940. We're very glad that the Prime Minister of Britain had not forgotten the cartoon. We hope he never does. We suggest that a few copies be struck off for distribution among the peacemakers of 1946. Mr. Molotov and Mr. Burns would be well advised to decorate their shaving mirrors with that picture of the weeping child. We cannot think of a better way for them to start their day. Stalin's Yalta promise to democratize Eastern Europe was broken in Bucharest the week after it was made. The Soviet Empire is already reaching from Finland to the borders of Greece, and the Grand Alliance of the so-called democracies of the West has long since ceased to be a mere diplomatic threat as the politicos haggle away another summer on such issues as the two-thirds voting procedure. That Grand Alliance looms over the arguments as a blunt political fact. The United States and the Soviet Union, it turns out, are going to stand together on the broad question of the veto. Borders will be disputed, but the main border is past dispute. The borderline of a divided world shows black enough for the least observant of the observers to spell it out of the headlines. Blocks versus majorities, the big powers versus the small. These are matters for 1,000 editorials today, but most folks who follow the news, even in the most casual sandwich of comic strips, know what time of day it is. And perhaps even the diplomats have taken note that this, in very truth, is the 11th hour. Take me to the Luxembourg Palace, said the newspaper man, according to his own dispatch. To the palace, of course, said the cab driver, where you're all busy preparing for the next war. Collective security, the one world of Roosevelt and Wilkie and Litvinov, are the ashes of dreams. Empires expand and shrink. Borders are pushed back and forth over the hapless heads of the peoples of Europe. The Russian half of our poor little globe is an armed camp. America has defaulted as champion of the freedoms. In foreign policy, Roosevelt's party is playing the Republican game, and Britain's Labour Party is dancing the old dance of death, while the old Tory idea, the Tory ignorance and Tory cowardice, call the tune. Curious. I seem to hear a child crying. No, I'm afraid the Palace of Luxembourg is more likely to be remembered in ages hence as the place where Tom Paine wrote The Age of Reason. Along the Potomac, the dawn rose quiet and cool. Around the floor of the Senate, tired colored men were bent over the worn carpet, picking up the refuse left behind by the 79th Congress of the United States. Among the Senate porters, more than one must have muttered, "Good riddance." And as he swept thoughtfully beneath the seats of Senator Bilbo and Senator Eastland, the gentleman from Mississippi, he must have dreamt a happy little dream of someday putting that broom of his to more effective service in the hygiene of the United States Senate. This Sunday in Washington is as dead a Sunday as was ever known in Zion, Illinois. Even the White House is empty. Mr. Harry Truman is down in Missouri in the hopes of stifling a human roadblock named Roger Slaughter, a congressman in Kansas City. Some people think Mr. Truman ought to stay out of local politics. Others think he never should have left local politics. State Department's like a tomb. Mr. Jimmy Burns is in Paris. Mr. Dean Acheson sits in his Maryland farm today, licking a few wounds. The undersecretary took a bad beating during the last few hours of the 79th Congress. Well, maybe he didn't take them personally. You and I and the family next door, we're all a little black and blue. For one thing, it was a little matter of a world court. Oregon Senator Morse moved that the Senate vote a treaty accepting jurisdiction of the new world court in all international cases. In other words, the treaty said, we will not only join the court, but will abide by its decisions. We will not hold out a veto power on whether or not we would play ball if we thought the decisions would go against us. This veto power is what Burns is opposing in Paris now, and Baruch is fighting in New York. Of all the opponents of the veto power, the most enthusiastic is that triumvirate of statesmen, Tom Connolly, Arthur Vandenberg, and John Foster Dulles. Mr. Dulles, in his wisdom, has decided that he doesn't like the possible compulsory decisions of the World Court. Mr. Dulles, it seems, wants the United States to have a veto power in the court. This, mind you, is the identical Mr. Dulles who writes those nice long articles in Life magazine calling for war on Russia because the Bolsheviks, those unreasoning savages of the East, refuse in their oriental ignorance to give up the veto power. This is the same Mr. Dulles who drafts some reservations to the World Court Bill. Reservations. Do you know what that word means, reservations? Does it ring a bell somewhere in the back of your mind? Does it strike an unpleasantly familiar chord in your memory of other peace conferences? Reservations? That's precisely the word used by the Honorable Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge when he fought the League of Nations in 1920. Reservations. We killed the League with reservations. The reservations of Mr. Dulles were rendered up in legislative form to his favorite senator, Mr. Vandenberg. These reservations were introduced in turn by Mr. Vandenberg to the Senate. Against these reservations, Mr. Morse battled with stubborn persistence and a stout heart, but to no avail. Up stands the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Connolly, and backs up a queer, gray, formless object known as bipartisan foreign policy. And the result? We have approved the World Court Treaty with reservations. What does that mean, Daddy? It means we have the veto power. Isn't that nice, Daddy? Does that mean the other countries have the veto power? Certainly not. The veto power is like the atom bomb. It's very dangerous if anybody else has it. Memo for the U.S. Mint. Put a new motto on the penny. In us we trust. Curious. You seem to hear a child crying. What do you say to sending 1,000 American students to every major country of Europe and sending 1,000 of their students here? All those thousands and thousands of young people multiplied by the friends they're bound to make ought to make it a little more imperative for the governments of the world to get along together in a sensible climate of good fellowship. I don't mean the students could do it all by themselves, but they could do their bit. Well, there was a bill providing for such a worldwide exchange. Tom Connolly allowed that the $10 million it called for was just another case of foolish spending, but the friends of the bill finally got the elder statesman to see it their way, and it would have been put to a yea or nay if Lister Hill of Alabama hadn't asked the gentleman from Texas if he would yield. Well, Sir Tom yielded, and Lister Hill took off on an hour's oration concerning the defenses of Pearl Harbor. This gave Tom time to talk to some other thinkers and to remember his train reservations home. Tom didn't want to lose those reservations. There goes that word again, reservations. By the time the senator from Alabama finished his address, that fine exchange project was just another matter for the dustbin of the 79th Congress of the United States of America. And yet, you know, out of all this stupid blundering and floundering, this awful mess, more than a few good bills have been born. Congress is a right confusing thing to watch. Fair estimate of any Congress is hard to come by. The 79th Congress, just for example, the same Congress that scuttled full employment, that failed to pass an anti-lynch bill or to destroy the poll tax, is the Congress that surprised even itself and passed Bretton Woods and the United Nations Charter. Yes, the same Congress that went on that strike-breaking binge of recent and unhappy memory, the same Congress that let the OPA wither and die, increased appropriations for the sick and needy, and passed a much better than decent bill for the control of atomic energy. Almost its last accomplishment belongs on the credit side of the ledger. The La Follette-Monroney bill, for which we've beaten a couple of drums in this program, is now law. It reorganizes Congress itself and brings the machinery of lawmaking to a point of efficiency that's almost up to date. Because of this bill, the 80th Congress will find itself in many respects a new kind of organization. And the congressmen of the 80th Congress themselves are going to be a little better paid. That ought to mean that fewer of our representatives will suffer in the future from Andy May's kind of heart trouble. All in all, we've had a lot of disappointments this year from Washington, but the good word is that our brand of democracy is still in working order and open for business. Last week, I read you an affidavit from a Negro soldier named Isaac Woodward. You remember that he was taken off a bus in South Carolina by a policeman and beaten until he was blinded in both eyes. I have before me a letter from Mr. H. Odell Weeks, who, it seems, is the mayor of the city of Aiken in the state of South Carolina, where, according to the soldier's affidavit, he was blinded. The mayor encloses affidavits of his own, sworn to by the city recorder, by the city chief of police, and by a couple of patrol officers. Now, these gentlemen deny all knowledge of the incident. It is indeed unfortunate, writes Mr. Weeks. And these are his exact words. Quote, that you did not fully verify this story before you broadcasted it. Unquote. The mayor goes on to say that since my broadcast went out to the nation, and since according to the affidavits, the locale of the story was wholly untrue, he, the mayor, urges that I have the courage and forthrightness to retract the wrong I have done his city, giving to my own retraction the same emphasis I placed upon the original broadcast. Well, Mr. Weeks, I hardly know how to make affidavits of your city recorder and city policeman as emphatic as Mr. Woodward's in the Hospital for the Blind. If it turns out to be true that the city of Aiken is blameless of this hideous scandal, it is my duty to make that innocence as public as possible, and I hope to be able to. But I must warn you that denials are never dramatic, and if I'm to say something exciting about Aiken, it will have to be something better than that a Negro boy was never blinded in its streets. I look forward to giving the subject of Aiken all the emphasis it deserves, but I'm bound to fail without some affirmative material. There are thousands of cities where Negro soldiers have not been blinded. I hope it will be my privilege to announce that your city is one of these. But since the broadcast is going to go out, as you put it, to the nation, let's spice up the retraction with a little good news. I won't ask you what the city of Aiken has done for Negro soldiers or for Negroes or for the blind. I'll only ask you if you're willing to join with me in a manhunt. A man dressed as a policeman, blinded, a discharged veteran. The blinded boy swears that his tormentor told him he came from the Aiken police. It is surely a more urgent matter for you to apprehend this imposter before he commits further outrages in your city's name than it is to exact from a commentator the cold comfort of apology. You'll get the apology when the facts are clear. Until then, you must understand why it must be deferred. After all, Mr. Weeks, I have not only the affidavits of your policeman, I have also the affidavit of the blinded soldier. Working on the meager clue that there is also an Aiken County, I've sent investigators there and to your city. Who should bring out the truth, unless it is too skillfully hidden? The soldier might easily have made a mistake, but there's a man in a policeman's uniform who made a worse mistake. And all the retractions in the world won't cleanse the name of Aiken till we find that man. I assure you, Mr. Weeks, I do not doubt the word of your police chief, your patrol officers, or your city recorder, but neither do I doubt the word of the blinded Negro boy. His suffering gives his oath a special validity, and I would take it against the Supreme Court and the President of the United States. Let us say he misunderstood what was said to him, or let us say he was lied to. But just saying that isn't enough. Your city's honor is certainly more important than my pride, but honor and pride are piddling trifles beside a pair of eyes. If it is your point that the boy was lied to, it is my point that we must all of us refuse to rest till we've unmasked the liar. If you want me to say that this awful thing did not happen in your city, then there's an American soldier who believes that it did happen in your city. And I cannot forget that. It is to him, Mr. Weeks, that you should address your first and most indignant letters. They will, of course, need to be transcribed in Braille. Now I see my time is just about up. That's all I have to say to you for the moment, Mr. Mayor of Aiken, and you, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming to this part of your dial at this part of a Sunday. Please let me join you next week at the same time, and let me hear from you. Your letters are much appreciated. We like reading them on this program. Till next week, then, same time, same station. I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.